Well, I'm delighted to say that joining me on the Godcast today is Louise Fay, otherwise known as the Chronic Warrior. And we'll come on to that in a little while. Louise, it's fabulous to get you on the Godcast. How are you this morning?
I'm great, thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. Whereabouts is home for you?
Home is Rotherham. So just outside Sheffield, Northern Lass.
Born and bred Rotherham girl?
Selby originally, so North Yorkshire, moved away for university and policing and all that sort of stuff, and then gravitated back to Yorkshire with my new life, so here we are.
Yeah, so just let's start back in Selby then. What was school days like for you, Louise? Were they fun times?
Yeah, yes, to a certain extent. I think I'm glad that I was at school back in the 80s and 90s and not at school now. But growing up, as I was adopted to a wonderful family. My mum and dad were amazing. And brought me up in a wonderful little mining town of Selby, really. I did find, though, to a certain extent, that I didn't fit in at school. Primarily because I was the brownest girl in my school, funnily enough. And that kind of brings me on to the message that I'm trying to bring into sport, is trying to find role models for young women and girls who look and sound like you, whether that be from disability or through diversity.
Yeah. And if you're happy to touch on the adoption stuff, Louise, were you informed or did you ask about that situation?
Yeah, I was absolutely informed. So my brother, who's 5 years younger than me, he's also adopted. And so I was fully involved in that process, and it was quite amazing. And I remember going into primary school and telling everybody that my brother was coming on a stalk, because that was the way that it was kind of explained to me through storybooks and why mummy couldn't have children and things like that. And so I was very much part of that process. I remember eating stacks of cheese sandwiches while they were bundling him into the car from the foster parents.
And did that, I've seen these, I like these programs where, you know, these kind of families that hook up years down the line. Has that become an inquisitive area for you of exploration or not?
Interestingly enough, when I first started having problems with my pelvis and my back, that was when I became most inquisitive about it. And it's never been to try and find a relationship. It was to try and find out history about myself. So at that point, I actually did manage to contact my birth mother, found her on the wonderful world of Facebook, as you do. But unfortunately, that kind of it was one conversation. I kind of got the answers that I needed around the challenges that I was having physically at the time. Mm-hmm. But I've never felt that need to find a relationship there, because I have the most amazing parents.
Yeah. And this is the Godcast, Louise. Was there any religious influence on you as a young person at all?
Yeah, so I went to Selby Abbey School and I was christened. And I used to go to church with my grandparents every other Sunday. And I was part of the Rainbows and Brownies and Guides. So again, I used to do a lot of the parades and things like that. And so it was a bit of part of my life growing up, actually.
Yeah, and your health was good through primary school, was it? Was there any signs of problems?
Yeah, so from the age of around 7, I had problems with my knees. And I was very active, very sporty. So I actually swam my first length in the pool before I was 3. it sounds kind of crazy, but yeah, I've always been really sporty. So around the age of 7, I was having problems with my knees. And my parents were taking me back and forth to the hospital and the doctors. And for the most part, they thought it was growing pains. But fast forward 20 odd years, and if we look back now and we say, had they have looked maybe above and below my knees, they would have seen that there was a problem with the pelvis. And it might have well been, you know, something that could have been sorted when my bones were soft and when I was younger.
Right. And is that something you resent in any way that was never discovered, or?
For a good while, yes. In the process between sort of finding that out, that information out, the surgery failing and coming into the retirement from the police, Yes, absolutely. There was a good year where my mental health really, really did take a turn for the worst. And that's why boxing, and I don't mind saying it, boxing saved my life. Yeah. But yeah, going back to that year, I spent a lot of time looking back and finding. But, you know, once I kind of found peace with my new life, so to speak, I started to embrace it. And there goes my mantra of embracing life's challenge one punch at a time. You know, I'll take a little bit of that message and apply it to anything in life. It certainly helped me get through.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I want to come to the positive aspect of this definitely, but just if we can just stick on primary school, you know, you said at the beginning that you stood out, you were a person of color, you were the brownest kid in the school, and then you have these problems in the knees. Did that cause issues for you in your relationships at primary school? You know, just tell people what it was like being the brownest girl in the school at a young age.
Yeah, do you know, the thing was, I didn't really understand what the issues were, because at that time I didn't identify myself as a person of colour. I just thought I was a person. And, you know, I think anything around bullying and racism or sexism, whatever it may be, I feel is learned behaviour. But you don't understand that as a child. And I remember one really quite awful occasion when I was around 12, and a girl from the neighbouring school came and knocked on my door at home. And I'm not going to say the word, but I think you'll know what I mean. She knocked on my door and she said, "Will you go back to P-Land where you came from?" She was referring to Pakistan. I'm not from Pakistan, just to say and clarify, not that it matters if I was. But that gave me, I ended up having to turn to my mum and say, what does she mean? I don't understand. And my parents, because there was very little information on the adoption paperwork, my parents didn't identify me as that either. So we lived in quite a naive world. Mm. Maybe had we have been given that information, like my parents had been given that information through the adoption, and they would have been able to help me with it, we would have been able to tackle that a little bit better growing up.
Yeah, and high school, in my experience, was slightly more crass and more abusive environment than perhaps primary school was. And did that extend more as you got older through high school? Did you see more examples of racism?
Yeah, a little bit actually. And I often think that it wasn't necessarily directed at the colour of my skin, but it was the one thing that made me different. And I was, like I said at the beginning, I was very, very sporty. So I was massively into football, swimming, all sorts of different things. So I used to hang around with the boys. I was a very boy, like a tomboy kind of person. And so I found it quite difficult to make relationships and friendships with the girls. Because, yeah, I wasn't into the makeup and the getting dressed up and all of that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it was a challenging time.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, you're not just got... you're not just dealing with that, but you're growing as well, and your body's developing. And so I guess the issue with your knees progressed. How was that visibly shown, Louise? How did it come across, and how did you recognize it?
Do you know what? It kind of just became a natural thing. Teachers, peers, when it comes to sports, you know, PE day or whatever, teachers would automatically say, "Have you got your knee braces? Have you, you know, things like that." So it just became normality that I had a problem, but we didn't look at how we could tackle that problem. you know, and again, that's something that I'm trying to do now, is work with young people with disabilities in schools to provide sports specific training for these young people. You know, so things like cross country, that was never something that I could do, but there was never an alternative.
No,
it's that lack of understanding of how to, okay, so that might not work, but there's always another way that something can work. So yeah, so it was quite challenging.
Yeah. So wearing knee braces is quite away from losing the ability to walk. So when did that progress? When did it become really quite serious as a condition that was going to change the rest of your life, really?
Yeah, so throughout my later teens, I kind of managed the issue in the sense that there's someone at my door.
There's somebody at Louise's door. I want to see who it is, Louise. Get them on the camera. Drag them in.
Patience. Give me 2 seconds.
We'll just pause it there. We're back now. Louise has just answered the door. Louise, was it anything exciting? That's what we all want to know. Was it worth the trip?
A lovely little box of treats from the beauty kitchen,
Wow.
vitamins and all things to keep me going, keep me strong.
Yeah. Excellent. So we were saying about how it progressed and how that kind of showed itself. Just carry on what you were saying there.
As a teenager, I started to manage things myself, and it to the point that when I was a dancer as well. So my parents would take me to dance class on a Saturday morning. I'd wait for them to leave, and then I'd go and hide at my friend's house for 3 hours because I didn't want to my parents to realise just how bad things were.
Right.
I started to protect them from my problems, really. So started just to scale back the sport, but secretly. And then going into adult life, when I joined the police, that's when it really started to come in the sense that I was doing a lot of patrol work. So first couple of years, I was out on the beat, whether that was on a bike or walking, and I was in absolute agony with my pelvis and my back and my knees. And I started taking annual leave off the back of my rest days to give myself time to recover. And I was living this life where I was hiding all of these problems,
Right.
manage it myself. And it just got to a point where I really, really couldn't. I was in too much pain. So, long story short, back with the referrals with the hospital and things, and they identified a problem with my pelvis. And it was worse with the right hip. So it was a suggestion of have this surgery, which on the face of it was quite a straightforward surgery, albeit a few hours. And the plan was I'll be walking again perfectly fine. And then if the left side gets too bad, we'll repeat the process on the left side. Unfortunately, that surgery failed. And it was no fault of anybody's, but it left me with some nerve damage in my right leg. And it just so happens that my body responds to trauma in a different way, and so it creates this neuropathic pain. And it was at that time that they identified the issue with my spine. So I just want to clarify, I can walk, but I do use crutches, and I use a wheelchair for anything more than kind of a supermarket shop. So that just gives you an idea of my mobility, should I say. So yeah, and then that was the progression into the retirement, really.
And I suppose, I mean, becoming a police officer was, I guess, a bit of a dream. Was it something that you'd really aspired to? And to have that kind of draw to a close at a young age, that must have been really difficult, was it?
Yeah, absolutely. I literally could only ever see me climbing the lofty heights of the police ranking system. And it was my life. I'd always kind of wanted to be a police officer. I went off to uni and got myself my English degree as something to fall back on. That experience. But yeah, it was something that I'd always wanted to do. I'd wanted to do go on to firearms. I was very active. But because of the issues I was having, I went sort of more into the intelligence side again to manage that side of things. So yeah, when that came to a close, the medical retirement process started. I really fought that for around 9 months, and just kept saying, please give me more time. Let's see if I recover. Let just give me that chance. But unfortunately, it became clear that that wasn't going to happen, and that takes me back to that year of sadness and sorrow. But that was the driving force behind where I am now, and it
Yeah.
happens for a
Can you remember that day where you actually, when it was kind of done and dusted, that was it? Your police career was over. Can you remember that? Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I tried to make it as positive as possible. And my best friend, Claire, made that really. So we joined together. And I said, if I joined with you, I'm going to finish with you. And so she actually took the day off work on my last day. And we went and we did shopping and we went for dinner and we had drinks. And then we made sure that I was home for midnight, like Cinderella, to kind of process that time. And so, yeah, we kind of finished it the way that I started it on a positive.
Yeah. And Louise, it's absolutely, I mean, I've always been speaking to you for 15 minutes, but it's clear you radiate positivity and you've kind of got a priest there going, oh, tell me about the bad times. But the reason I want to do that is because, you know, a lot of people that watch this sometimes feel they are in a bad place. So, and in a moment we will joyfully celebrate the good stuff. But that year, just tell us about that year and how difficult it was for you.
It was so difficult. It got to a point where I couldn't even go into a shop by myself and make a decision on what to buy. My anxiety levels were just through the roof and I felt like I had no purpose, no plan, no future. Everything that I'd worked for, everything that was around me was having to change. I had to sell my home to be closer to my family, or everything that I'd worked for just felt like it had gone. I was on 28 tablets a day, managing my pay. So, as a result of that, I was slurring my words. I couldn't make sense of anything. It was just, yeah, it was horrendous. And I couldn't, at that point, I didn't know how I was going to get out. I really didn't.
And how did you? What was the light in the darkness for you? Who were the? Tell us about the people and the things that were important to you during that time.
Well, absolutely, my parents, 100%. The patience that they had with me, and you know, they were amazing. From the physical things that they did, just to the emotional side of things. But a game changer for me was going back into a gym. I'd kind of come to the end of sort of like the occupational therapy and the physio and that sort of stuff, and you kind of get left in this abyss of what do I do now? You know, is this where everything just kind of goes downhill? So I got myself a gym membership and I got a personal trainer, and he was doing a lot of rehabilitation work with me, and sort of continuing that occupational therapy. And we were just talking one day and I pointed to the punch bag in the corner, I could have boxed or given it a go when I could stand up and do sport from it. And the personal trainer, Lloyd, a very good friend of mine, now turned around and said, why don't you do it in your chair? And at that point, I could think of a million reasons why I couldn't do anything in life. But when he asked me that question, I couldn't give him an answer as to why not. And so we got my wheelchair out of the car. We went over to the punch bag. I got a pair of gloves out of a communal bin of gloves, which I do not recommend, by the way. It's not pretty. absolutely loved it. The next day I bought my own gloves. And that was genuinely the day that started to change my future.
Yeah. And Louise, so, you mentioned you, it's clear that your parents are vitally important to you. How did they cope with your situation? You know that, you know, I mean, I'm a parent. Nobody likes to see their children going through turmoil and anxiety. Did it take their toil on them? And have they recovered from all that situation now?
It certainly did, and from their perspective, they felt that they were to blame. They felt responsible, primarily because things had been missed when I was young. And so that was where it was my job to explain to them that I could see and I knew that they did everything that they possibly could to help me, and to learn that things that aren't within your control, you can't beat yourself up for the outcome. And so that was a process, very much so. But I think with the boxing and this the progression into me being fitter and stronger now than I ever had been, mentally and physically, all of that has really reassured them that I can embrace life's challenges one punch at a time. I remember when I told them that I wanted to box, the fear, and they were like, oh my gosh, Louise, you've already got enough things going on, why do you need to be doing this to yourself, gosh, you're gonna get, you know, gonna get injured and this and that. And that's because there's a preconception about, you know, about boxing and what I was about to be doing. But again, that understanding, that working together and talking things through throughout the whole process. I'm constantly on the phone to my parents. I see them every week. And so, yeah, it was a process. And yes, they did feel a lot of guilt, but they didn't need to. It wasn't for them.
No. And it's clear you're a real advocate for people who are different, who may have a disability. Just tell us about a life of normality, inverted commas, if you're listening to this, to a life living with disability. I've been very fortunate in my life. The only kind of experience I had was when my now dearly departed grandma needed to use a wheelchair, and I took her into town for the first time. This was 3 or 4 years ago. And it was only then when I actually realised how difficult life is if you are not living what is perceived a normal life. Just taking her from a car to the bank was an effort. It was a real struggle for me, pushing her, getting up the steps and whatnot. Was it a difficult transition for you, or did you embrace that quite well, would you say?
It was a difficult transition. And I remember the first time that I acknowledged that in order to do a specific thing, I would need a wheelchair. And up until this point, I'd avoided anything that I couldn't physically do on my crutches. So if it wasn't a 10-minute jobby or a sit down, go for lunch or something, I didn't do it. And that wasn't me. I'd restricted life so much. But every year I used to go to the clothes show in Birmingham with my friend, my best friend, the girl I was just telling you about, Claire. And it was coming up to the December and we wanted to go. And I knew there was no way I could do this on crutches. It wasn't even a consideration. So it was the time where we had the conversation about getting a chair. And I was quite positive about ordering the chair. I was like, I don't think it had really sunk in at that point. So I was like, oh, that's nice. It's black and orange. Oh, yeah, that's really pretty. And then the box arrived and that was when the reality kind of hit. And I had the box in my front room for about a week, didn't open it. The second week, I opened the box and I took the chair out. I didn't unfold the chair. The third week, I unfolded the chair and I move around the house, and I had to do it in that gentle process because just so overwhelming to even see a reflection of myself sitting down in this chair. All of those things I needed to start to process, and then I managed that, and we got to the clothes show and I was being all positive, and this was my first experience, Alex, of being out in public in a wheelchair. So we get to the clothes show. She's pushed me to the coffee shop that we always go to. And I roll up to the coffee, to the counter, and I speak to the barista. And I say, can I have a cappuccino and a mocha? And he looked at me and didn't speak. He turned round. He started to make the drinks. He turned back around and said to my friend, does she want sugar? And that was my first experience of being in a wheelchair. This man didn't want to speak to me. He wanted to speak to he thought was my carer.
Yeah, yeah, gosh.
So we scrapped the coffee and we went to the Prosecco bar.
it's just a really simple anecdote, but it's massive, isn't it, really? It's just a massive, that's how people... perceptions and mindsets towards people who are slightly different. I get a weird look sometimes if I'm just walking around in my dog collar, so I can't begin to imagine what it's like for for somebody with, you know, with life-changing situations. Just before we get to the more positive stuff, the psychological aspect of your recovery, Louise, was that done through exercise and boxing, or did you get psychological counselling or help in dealing with that? I think it's important to talk about that if you're happy to.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had counselling and I had cognitive behavioural therapy. And it was also around the same time that I discovered aromatherapy. So when you're a police officer, there's a scheme that you can pay into called the Benevolent Fund. And there's three locations in the country where you can go and have intensive rehabilitation if you're part of that system. And I went there for 2 weeks for some recovery on the leg and psychological assistance. And I discovered aromatherapy there. I went on an aromatherapy course. And that was the impetus for me to then become an aromatherapist. So the counselling, the CBT, the aromatherapy, I learned meditation, changed my diet. There were so many little chinks to the armour that I was creating to start fighting this battle. But yes, counselling and cognitive behavioural therapy were a very big part of it, helping me process and then look forward.
Yeah. And then the boxing, you know, to do it as a personal interest, as a personal hobby, to just for personal well-being, has now developed into this title of the Chronic Warrior, which I think is brilliant. Just tell us a bit about that story, Louise, and how that has gone from personal interest, personal well-being and fitness, to this kind of wider enterprise that's getting recognised nationally now.
Yeah, so going back to that day that I put the gloves on for the first time, I went home that evening and started researching wheelchair boxing, adaptive boxing, disability, however you wanted to put it. And there were some examples of it, but to me, it didn't really demonstrate the craft and the art form of boxing. It had been scaled back, and it was quite, I'd say the word barbaric, actually. So some of the things I'd seen were two wheelchairs locked together and men just literally punching each other in the head and no escape. And you wouldn't tie feet together, would you, in standing boxing and expect them to punch each other. So I'm doing all this research, and there's just, I could see that it wasn't regulated. There weren't any specific coaches, but there was an interest. And found a Facebook group, and I joined a Facebook group. And within that group, there was somebody from the World Boxing Council. And they contacted me and said, you know, you seem really into this. We've seen a few bits and pieces that you posted on Facebook. Can we come and have a little look at you? I was like, yeah, no problem. So they came over. And within 3 months of that happening, I'd been invited to the World Boxing Council annual convention in Mexico. And I was there to launch their recreational safer adaptive boxing program, which was just a whirlwind to get to that point. And then on my return from there, I started to work alongside the national governing bodies of the amateur sport of boxing, and raised this question of, you know, can this become a regulated sport? Can this become something that you will support? And to a certain extent, initially, the answer was no, because of this lack of understanding, because of what was seen on YouTube and what's out there so far. And so from that point to now, has been a 3-year process of working really, really hard to demonstrate all of the benefits of this sport and to develop the craft of the sport. And if I could say that adaptive boxing is like boxing, ballet and chess, all rolled into one, that would start to give you an appreciation of just how much you have to be able to do just with your hands.
Yeah. And what kind of numbers have reached out to this? You've got, so this is kind of a national, international thing now, is it, where people are kind of, you're a bit of a pioneer, Louise, aren't you? You're a bit of a role model and yeah. Groundbreaker. It's quite exciting, isn't it?
So it's very exciting and sometimes quite overwhelming, actually. So when I came back from Mexico, the first process for me was to become qualified as a coach. And I became one of two people in the UK that had taken their amateur boxing course from a wheelchair. But the other person wasn't practicing, wasn't teaching. And so, yeah, that was an interesting experience in itself. It's something that I've spoken about before. So the few days of my England boxing course, I was made to sit on a black mat in my wheelchair because they thought that I might damage the floor with my chair. And so it was quite strange in that on that course that I should have been learning, I was actually teaching coaches of 30 years plus experience in traditional boxing of this new craft. And that was when it kind of, the realization hit that there was so much work to do in this sport, you know?
Yeah. Has that been recognized by professional boxers? I know we have a mutual friend in Kelly Maloney, who's just a wonderful person. Just, you know, what's been the response from the kind of the, you know, the hierarchy of the boxing world? You know, have we had Tyson Fury in touch yet?
No, I've not had Tyson in touch, but he does do some adaptive boxing with a friend of mine called Sean Gash, who is an ambassador for RGK wheelchairs. And so Tyson is very much an advocate for disability boxing. But from Chronic Warrior side of things, we've worked with Terry Harper. Natasha Jonas is a massive supporter of ours and spent a couple of days with her in the wheelchair, and have been involved in the Driving Force series on ITV with Natasha, and Katie Taylor obviously is the headline girl in that, and the pioneer of women's boxing. It's the giants of like her that we're going to be standing on the shoulders of, you know. So it's amazing. We work with VIP in Manchester, which is Jamie Moore's gym, and the home of champions such as Cal Frampton. Josh Warrington came from there, Chantel Cameron. And the support that we've had from those world-class athletes has been phenomenal. The appreciation that they've had when they've sat in the chair and gone, oh my gosh, no, I'm going to stand up and do this. Thank you very much. You know? And yeah, that's been amazing. And they can see a need for this, Alex.
Yeah.
You know. And put it like this, people often say, oh gosh, you're in a wheelchair, you don't want to be hurt anymore. Okay. That's often a response that we get. But I remember having a conversation with Terry Harper and saying, she's a world champion. So God forbid that anything like this would ever happen. But if she had a car accident and she lost a leg from below the knee, let's go with that. And this is the conversation that we had. Does that mean her boxing future is over, or should she be allowed to compete? Now, as it stands now, there would be no facility for her to compete regulated adaptive boxing. Now, how wrong is that? When it's as simple as that, you know? And so, yeah, that's why I do believe that there's a need for it as a competitive sport. And even from a non-contact side of things, and again, this was within the same conversation with Terry. So I appreciate that there are many people with disabilities who will never be able to take part in the contact version of the sport. But I work with Great Britain Disability Boxing, who in turn are working with Swansea University to develop a VR headset and pressure pad system so that you could have two boxers with brain, for example, who could have contact, but they are in the boxing ring with these VR headsets, with these air pressure pads. So if I throw a shot and you didn't defend it, you'd feel air pressure and it would count as a landing blow at one point. You know, so whether it's an amputation or a brain injury, I believe everybody should be able to be involved in this sport.
Well, Louise, you are an incredibly inspiring woman. You really are. I'm just honoured to have this conversation with you. Just, and what about actually, you know, I, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, is this something that could work at somewhere like the Invictus Games? Is there been possibilities of that happening?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, GB Disability Boxing, they're very much in touch with Invictus. One of our mentors is a veteran himself, has post-traumatic stress disorder, and he has collapsed arches in his feet. And so he's reached out to Walking with the Wounded, for example. And so, yes, absolutely, from an Invictus perspective, there's a lot of scope. And actually, veterans have been boxing in wheelchairs since the Second World War as rehabilitation. You know, so we're now talking 70 years and we're still not doing it. So it is very much for everybody. But my goal is to get this to the Paralympics. And I promise you, Alex, I will not stop until it's there.
You don't need to promise, Louise. I can tell you are incredibly driven by this. I can see you. I was going to ask you about your goals and aspirations, but I think you've explored those and explained them to them. And just boxing as a sport, Louise, is it, you know, probably people might be surprised to hear a vicar say that he loves boxing, but it's a sport I really do enjoy. Have you got a few heroes in the boxing world? Who are your kind of guys you think, wow, mine is Barry McGuigan. It always has been. I was a huge fan of Barry McGuigan. What about yourself?
Yeah, a few actually. So Clarissa Shields is somebody who I've always looked up to.
Just say a bit about her, Louise, because you know, female boxing is definitely on the increase, but people out there won't be familiar with it. Tell us about Clarissa.
Yeah, so Clarissa, she boxed in the Olympics and then went on to be a three-weight world champion in professional boxing. So has got the trademark of the greatest woman of all time, the GOAT. And yeah, so undefeated up and down the weight classes and is currently the undisputed middleweight champion. She's popped over to MMA and popped back all at the tender age of 23. And to look up to somebody so young when I'm so old just kind of shows just what she achieved in the short space of time. She's only ever been put down once in her whole boxing career by somebody else who I really look up to, in Savannah Marshall. And that's going to be a super fight in June. Here hopefully in the UK. Katie Taylor, absolutely undisputed lightweight world champion, gold medalist at the 2012 Olympics herself, was the first female to be signed by Eddie Hearn at Matchroom, and has really paved the way, certainly in the UK, for women's boxing. And to be in the documentary with Katie, all about her life and legacy and what she's done. You talk about pioneers, she is the epitome of that. That was an incredible opportunity, and I was really, really privileged to do so. And then from a guy perspective, I look at people like Tyson Fury. You mentioned him earlier. He has overcome so much adversity, and what he's done for raising awareness within mental health, addiction, weight loss, weight gain, body positivity, the traveling community, all aspects of diversity that I don't actually think Tyson gets enough credit for, aside from being a phenomenal great and probably a historical great at boxing.
Absolutely, yeah. And Louise, what would you say to people who think that women just shouldn't be knocking 10 bells out the proverbial out of each other? What's your kind of adult response to that? You know, because I do kind of get it in some way. You know, it's like, you know, as a kid, it would be unheard of, wouldn't it? But now it's very much it's becoming more and more popular. What's your take on it? Obviously, you're going to say it's fine because you're a boxer, but...
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the work continues until the day that we say, Katie Taylor, the boxer, Louise Fay, the boxer, Tyson Fury, the boxer. Whether it's a male, a female, or an adaptive, we should not stop this fight until all of those categories are classed as boxers. For me, I feel it's more of an issue with the person who doesn't think women should fight or disabled people should box. So I think it's about changing that narrative and allowing other people's eyes to accept what they see. And for people who do think women shouldn't box, disabled people shouldn't box, talk to us. Tell me why you think women shouldn't box. And let's have that, like you say, adult conversation. And let me give you an adult response to explaining all of the reasons why we should. Let's have the conversation.
Fabulous. And Louise, just have you got anything you'd like to promote? Have you got a website, I take it? Tell us about where people can find more about you.
Well, just before I tell you about that, I want to tell you about something that we've launched literally this week on Monday, okay? And it leads very much on from what you just said about women in boxing. So, something I found very straight away going into boxing gyms is often there was either no female-specific toilet or there were no sanitary provisions in these toilets for the women and girls who were coming into the boxing gyms. So as a coach, I was getting a lot of women and girls coming up to me saying, I'm in this situation, can you help me? Okay. And I became an ambassador for Girls Just Want to Box. And when they asked me what I would like to change in boxing, whilst everybody was talking about 3-minute rounds, equal pay for women, my response was that I think every boxing gym should have sanitary provisions for women and girls. And we have launched on Monday Chronic Warrior UK campaign of women box, period. We are here to stay. And my challenge now is to provide sanitary provisions for all 226 amateur boxing clubs in Yorkshire and the Northwest regions in which we cover. And so I'm super proud to be launching that initiative this week.
Yeah, well, Louise, if we can help in that in the Northwest, do let me know and we will do our best to help and support you in that venture. That sounds it's just inspiring stuff, isn't it? It really is. And I just want to thank you, Louise, for coming on the Godcast. I like boxing. I don't know if you know Kathy McAleer. She's from Belfast. Yeah. She's Northern Ireland's only professional female boxer. She's been on the Godcast. So if anybody watching wants to just explore another avenue of boxing for women, then do check that out. But Louise, thank you so much for your time. You are an absolute inspiration, and I can only wish you continued success in bringing this sport to the world and to the UK. Thank you.
Thank you. You can find us at chronicwarrioruk.org.
Okay, Louise. God bless, and thanks again. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.